Hello, I'm Curtis Bowers, and this is Agenda Weekly. Thank you so much for joining me again this week. I really appreciate it. Subscribers, thank you so much for your support and kind notes and prayers. We really appreciate that. It's a blessing. Those listening on all the different platforms, please consider going to agendaweekly.com and subscribe there. It starts at $3 a month. That's all it is. You'll get a lot of the valuable resources we put out each week to help you understand the times and to be more effective at making a difference. But we need your support. Today is a very special, important episode that I hope you'll watch a couple times and then share with others to get this valuable information out to as many people as possible, because it's one of those big picture episodes where you pull back and it helps people see a bigger picture, which a lot of times then makes all the individual pieces of the puzzle make a lot more sense. But it's called The Best Enemies Money Can Buy. And I'll explain that with Alex Newman as we get into it. But anyway, I really appreciate you joining me. A couple quick news items before we get to the episode. Viktor Orban, I noticed, lost the election to the Soros-funded opposition, which is so sad. He was so much for faith, family, and freedom, and really trying to build Hungary into a very powerful, free nation. And now the new guy's going to just jump right into the EU and all their failed policies and bad ideas, which is really sad. Today, now, is The Best Enemies Money Can Buy with Alex Newman. Most of the big events of our lifetime, the major threats to our country over the last 100 years, if you dig in and pull back the curtain, you see the globalists, the elites, the deep state in America, where they've embedded into our government, have been the ones that have supported, funded, propped up, and encouraged almost all of them. And it's always the same my entire life without exception. They have these different threats to create the fear in us, which then gives the politicians just a carte blanche ability to do whatever they need to do, even if it's not constitutional, because we've got to stop this threat. But anyway, let's get started with that.
Hey, Curtis. Hey, everybody from Agenda Weekly. What an honor and a pleasure and a privilege to be back with you again. Thanks so much for having me. Today, I want to talk about the ongoing manufacturing of endless enemies and boogeymen to keep us occupied with perpetual wars, perpetual hysteria, always necessitating more government, less freedom, more taxes, more surveillance, etc. Obviously, the Iran war is the current thing du jour, if you will. And of course, we could spend a lot of time on that, how the CIA helped overthrow the very pro-America, very pro-West Shah, leading almost inevitably, of course, to the takeover of Iran by these goofy ayatollahs who, you know, never met a terrorist they didn't want to sponsor. But, you know, let's avoid Iran for now. I know that emotions are raw, it's very sensitive, but let's just go back and look at the history of how this has been going on for so many years. Almost every major enemy that the United States has had to fight over the last century has literally been at least helped by the U.S. government, by the globalist establishment that is determined to bring us into a new world order. And I think as we look at this, it'll make sense why they're constantly making these enemies for us to fight and for us to be scared of. So hopefully you guys can see that. And the best enemies that money can buy, which is, of course, an accurate description of what we're dealing with. And so, you know, this is an image that always stuck with me, right? My tax dollars, and somehow also my tax dollars. And like, that's literally going on right now, right? My tax dollars. So, you know, you got a lot of people who complain about the U.S. government sending money to Israel, $6 billion a year, give or take. And then you look at, they send about $20 billion a year to the Islamic and the Arab governments surrounding Israel, many of which have openly declared their desire to wipe Israel off the map. So you got my tax dollars, and somehow also my tax dollars. H.L. Mencken, you think about him whatever you like, but he was absolutely correct. He said the whole aim of practical politics is to keep the populace alarmed and hence clamorous to be led to safety by menacing it with an endless series of hobgoblins, all of them imaginary. And I'm not suggesting that all of the enemies of the United States are imaginary. Plenty of them are real, but they have been built up and groomed by forces in the United States, as we will see. We also see this hilarious little cartoon here. How would you like this wrapped? Should it be anti-terrorism or protect kids, the control of internet speech, or pick your tyrannical policy? But before we even dig into some of these enemies, I want to go back and share with you some insights from a very important globalist who was hired by the State Department back in 1962 to write a very important report about how we could get from a world basically of sovereign nation states to a world basically controlled by the UN. The title of the report itself was A World Effectively Controlled by the United Nations. And the goal was to help figure out how we could get from there to where we wanted to be, this global system. So the guy who was put in charge of this task, he was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was a longtime operative for the Office of Strategic Services, which was the precursor to the CIA. His name was Lincoln Bloomfield. And he argued that with organic trends, it would take hundreds of years before we could finally get to this one world system controlled by the United Nations. But he said we could do this much more quickly using a grave crisis or war to bring about a sudden transformation in national attitude sufficient for the purpose. He said that one of the ways to accelerate this process would be to use a crisis, a war, or a brink of war situation so grave or commonly menacing that deeply rooted attitudes and practices are sufficiently shaken to open the possibility of a revolution in world political arrangements. A few months ago, when we were talking about the regionalization of government, which is ongoing, we also mentioned this report because Lincoln Bloomfield actually talked about how these regional governments could be used to ultimately create the single global system. And of course, that's the strategy that they're pursuing. But today I want to focus in on the war element and how they're constantly building up these enemies. Now, the great French philosopher and lawmaker Frédéric Bastiat noticed this hundreds of years ago. He actually said that these totalitarians are always concocting the antidote and the poison in the same laboratory. In other words, they're creating the enemies that we are supposed to fight or the problems that they are going to allegedly solve for us. And it always helps them from their perspective to have a conflict that they can use. They use this in domestic politics. They use this at the international level in geopolitics, which is primarily what we're going to focus on today. But I want to show you that this pattern holds true. Now, the great historian Anthony Sutton from Stanford University actually identified this same pattern when it came to a very secretive organization called the Order of Skull and Bones, an introduction to America's secret establishment. He pointed out that this was basically a recruiting ground for a conspiracy to create a one-world government. ABC Fake News has talked about it. They got some secret footage of one of their weird little initiation rituals at their headquarters, the Tomb. I can show you guys real quick if you want to see.
So when we heard that some enterprising characters had managed to spy on the famous Skull and Bones Society, we couldn't resist. Here's ABC's Dan Harris.
The videotape provides a grainy glimpse into what appear to be the initiation rituals of a secret society that's been around since 1832. Whose members have gone on to be leaders of Wall Street and the White House, the Senate and the Supreme Court.
They're sort of trying to scare the initiates, make them, disorient them, frighten them.
New York Observer investigative reporter Ron Rosenbaum accompanied a team of Yale students who shot these pictures 9 days ago. Rosenbaum's curiosity about Skull and Bones was permanently piqued when, as a classmate of George W. Bush, he lived right next to the Tomb, the group's heavily fortified home. From their perch, Rosenbaum and his cohorts taped the Tomb's courtyard. What they captured, they say, was initiates known as neophytes being forced to kiss a skull, then members performing a mock killing.
I thought that was so interesting, a mock killing, that they do at the Skull and Bones. But that's also what they do at the Bohemian Grove, at Zurn in Switzerland. All these elites, globalist world leaders, presidents, prime ministers, they're involved in these things. It is just, it's so much darker and so creepy that these kind of people are who run the world. The Epstein associates and on it goes. One member of the Skull and Bones said, when I was researching this years ago, that they have them lay naked in the coffin, each new member, until they are approached by or have connection with some kind of spirit or whatever, which of course would be demons. But anyway, it's pretty amazing.
Pretty weird, right? Now, the reason we're talking about Skull and Bones is because in this book, Anthony Sutton explains how they work. They say that they use this dialectical process where change requires conflict, and conflict requires the clash of opposites. He says you can't just have a right, you have to have a right and a left. So we see this in domestic politics, right? Here's Bush and Kerry both running for president in 2004.
You were both in Skull and Bones, the secret society.
It's so secret we can't talk about it.
What does that mean for America? The conspiracy theorists are going to go
watch. I'm sure they are. I don't know. I haven't seen the website.
Number 322.
First of all, he's not the nominee. Look, I look forward.
Are you prepared to lose?
No, I'm not going to lose.
You both were members of Skull and Bones, a secret society at Yale. What does that tell us?
Not much, because it's a secret.
Yeah, what do you suppose the odds are that both major party presidential candidates come from the same tiny little secret society that recruits 15 new members every year? The odds, of course, are incredibly small. Now, there are many other members of this group we could talk about. One that comes to mind is William Buckley. He was supposedly Mr. Conservative. The fact that the New York Times and the Washington Post and NPR were all telling us that he was the leader of the conservative movement, that really should have given us a clue about what was going on. But notice, when it came to the Cold War, he says, we've got to accept big government for the duration, for neither an offensive nor a defensive war can be waged, given our present government skills, except through the instrument of a totalitarian bureaucracy within our shores. Isn't that interesting? We have to fight communism by having a totalitarian bureaucracy within our shores. You know, I'm all about fighting communism, but do we really fight communism with communism? Like, you know, if your house is burning down, does it help to go get a flamethrower and spray fire at your house? And of course it doesn't, right? It's utter foolishness. But that's the kind of thing that we're dealing with here. And so I want to stick with Anthony Sutton for a little bit because, you know, we think about communism, we think about the Soviet Union, and obviously the Soviet Union was a major threat. I would argue that the descendants of the Soviet Union, very much including the Russian Federation and a lot of the leadership there, remain a major threat to the United States. But we got to go back in history to find out how this threat even came to be. And I think probably the most important single book on this subject came again from Anthony Sutton, a historian at Harvard or at Stanford University. He did a book called Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, where he proves that the Soviet Union was really created with money from Wall Street megabanks, with support from some of the most powerful capitalists in the world. Why were the Rockefeller interests, the Morgan interests, interested in promoting communism? They gave millions of dollars to Vladimir Lenin, to Leon Trotsky, to aid and abet their wicked revolution that ended up enslaving that massive empire. And then, of course, at every step of the way after that, we helped and continued to build them up. There's a lot of documentation on this. One of the ones that I've read that I thought was so astounding was from Major Jordan's diaries. This was from George Racy Jordan, and he actually had served as a military officer. And what he observed in his time in the military was that the U.S. government, through the Lend-Lease program, was basically shipping not just weapons and food and every kind of supplies needed to the Soviet Union, to Joseph Stalin. They were also sending some of our most sensitive secrets, including our nuclear secrets, including the blueprints to be able to make nuclear bombs, including the components that they would need to make nuclear bombs. Why would you do that, right?
I read that book years ago. Major Jordan's diaries, and it's shocking. They wanted a powerful nuclear enemy to create the fear necessary for people to give up their freedoms, just like they wanted the terror threat to look so bad with September 11th. We'd give up all our constitutional rights with the Patriot Act because you've got to save us, whatever you have to do. Well, why did we drop bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki? A lot of people say, the textbooks say, because it saved a million soldiers' lives if we would have had to march in there. That's a total lie. Japan had tried to surrender to us for a long time, but we would let them. Our State Department said, no, you can't surrender. They wanted the world to see those bombs explode and go off. Why? Because then you'd be fearful of nuclear war the rest of your existence. And of course, that's why they gave the nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union, so they'd have that. And we'd just gotten to see those bombs go off in Japan, and the whole world was like, oh no. And so it would terrorize us, so then government is able to do whatever they need to do, no matter how unconstitutional, because we need to be saved from these threats.
He wrote another book, Anthony Sutton wrote another book called Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development, where he shows that American industry and the American government literally built the Soviet economy. We literally sent engineers over there to build factories for them and teach them how to run those factories, whether we're talking about engine factories, missile factories, car factories, which of course could be used for tanks and other military material. And we still see this kind of thing going on today, right? Vladimir Putin, obviously a former head of the KGB, or the predecessor, or the what succeeded the KGB, but he was a senior officer in the KGB. And here we have the head of the Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, admitting that Putin was one of the young global leaders that they trained to take positions of influence. Listen to this.
This notion to integrate young leaders is part of the World Economic Forum since many years. And I have to say, when I mention now names like Mrs. Merkel, even Vladimir Putin and so on, they all have been young global leaders of the World Economic Forum. Mm-hmm.
So Vladimir Putin was one of these young global leaders. Right? And even in the midst of an alleged war with Russia, we're still sending money to the Russians, right? The Pentagon is buying fuel made with Russian oil. Can you imagine, right? The Russians actually were earning more from their oil revenues in 2022 after the war broke out than they were in 2021. Isn't that amazing? You think of the Nazis. Well, again, we turn to Anthony Sutton. He did a wonderful book, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, where he shows that Wall Street financiers and international bankers literally subsidized the rise of Adolf Hitler to power. He shows that you had J.P. Morgan, Rockefeller, Standard Oil, National City Bank, Chase and Manhattan Banks, Kuhn Loeb and Company, all these mega capitalists in the United States funding National Socialism in Germany. Why? Right. In fact, going back to Skull and Bones for a moment, you might remember the Bush dynasty. Of course, we know George W. Bush and George H.W. New World Order Bush. George H.W. New World Order Bush's dad was U.S. Senator Prescott Bush. Of course, he was a director and a major shareholder in Union Bank of New York, which, of course, was busted bankrolling the Nazi regime. In fact, their assets were seized in 1942 under the Trading with the Enemy Act. So isn't that interesting? Okay. A lot of this is starting to come out now, right? How Bush's grandfather helped Hitler's rise to power. This is a mainstream publication, The Guardian. I want to read to you what the UK Guardian said. Even after America had entered the war and when there was already significant information about the Nazis' plans and policies, Prescott Bush worked for and profited from companies closely involved with the very German businesses that financed Hitler's rise to power. It's also been suggested that the money he made from these dealings helped establish the Bush family fortune and set up its political dynasty. And so now going back briefly to what we read from Lincoln Bloomfield in that State Department report, A World Effectively Controlled by the United Nations, how war can accelerate the globalization of the world. Of course, that's exactly what we saw, right? In the aftermath of World War I, we saw the rise of the League of Nations and other major institutions like the Bank for International Settlements. In the aftermath of World War II, we saw the birth of the United Nations, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the institutions that ultimately created the European Union, like the European Coal and Steel Community, which led to the European Free Trade Agreement, which ultimately led to the superstate we know today as the EU. So here we have multiple examples, and I want to point to one of the really significant ones, because I regard communist China as an existential threat to the United States today. The CCP is the most murderous regime that's ever existed in the history of humanity. It is a threat to not just the United States, but to freedom everywhere. But we need to go back in history to understand where this threat came from. So let's go all the way back to the 1920s, right? The Journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, it's called Foreign Affairs, published a piece attacking China's Christian leader, Chiang Kai-shek, who was very pro-America, by the way. And at the same time, you had known Soviet agents and assets within the U.S. government, people like Assistant Treasury Secretary Harry Dexter White, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, and then top State Department officials like Alger Hiss, openly attacking this man, Chiang Kai-shek, and painting the mass-murdering communist chairman Mao as some sort of agrarian reformer. Now, in 1935, the U.S. ambassador to Moscow, William Bullitt, wrote a letter, a memo, to Secretary of State Cordell Hull, and he said this: "It is the heartiest hope of the Soviet government that the United States will become involved in war with Japan. To think of the Soviet Union as a possible ally of the United States in case of war with Japan is to allow the wish to be the father of the thought. The Soviet Union would certainly attempt to avoid becoming an ally until Japan had been thoroughly defeated and would then merely use the opportunity to acquire Manchuria and Sovietize China." And I know what you're thinking. If you remember your World War II history, you're thinking that's exactly what happened. And of course it is, right?
Do you understand how significant that is? I'm going to read that again. That's our ambassador to Moscow in 1935. "It is the heartiest hope of the Soviet government that the United States will become involved in war with Japan." 6 years before at war with them, that's what the Soviets want. "To think of the Soviet Union as a possible ally of the United States in case of war with Japan is to allow the wish to be father to the thought." So they're saying, if you go to war with them, then we'll be partners with you. "The Soviet Union would certainly attempt to avoid becoming an ally until Japan had been thoroughly defeated and would then merely use the opportunity, listen to this, to acquire Manchuria and Sovietize China." 1935. That's the plan. I mean, it's unbelievable. "We're not going to help you fight Japan, but once they're defeated," and they came in 5 days after they were totally defeated, and then they took all their weapons and they marched into China and started supporting Mao. But Lenin had said that in the 20s, 15 years before that. "First we will take Eastern Europe, then the masses of Asia. We will circle the last bastion of capitalism, the United States, and we won't need to fight. They'll fall like a ripe fruit into our hands." He'd already laid that out in 1920. This is what we're going to do. And World War II, that's all it was about, is allowing to soften up Eastern Europe so the Soviets could take them over, which they took over several of the countries before the end of the war. And then to soften up Japan, provoke them to attack. And yes, they were evil and everything. I'm not saying that. But it was all a plan from 1920 by Vladimir Lenin, and then even spoken again in 1935 by our ambassador to Moscow. Here's our plan. We want to Sovietize China, take over that whole area, but you first got to blast Japan into the Stone Age, and then we'll come in at the end after they're defeated and take over everything, which they did.
The U.S., during the war, sent hundreds of ships to arm the Soviets to fight Japan, and yet the Soviets sat on the sidelines until the very end. Literally days before the war was over, the Soviets declared war. Stalin declared war on Japan. And because Stalin got to be one of the victorious parties, and by the way, Stalin declared war on Japan after the U.S. had dropped a nuclear bomb on Hiroshima. There was no longer any question about where this war was going. It was just a question of the terms of surrender. And so then Stalin declares war just days before the war is over. And because he was one of the victorious allies who defeated the Japanese, he was able to get all the Japanese stockpiles in Manchuria, which of course was instantly Sovietized. And then they sent all of those weapons and supplies to their little buddy, Chairman Mao, so that he could arm his terror squads and they could take over China, exactly as our ambassador predicted was going to happen. General Patrick Hurley, who was the U.S. ambassador to China at the end of World War II, says that American diplomats surrendered the territorial integrity and the political independence of China and wrote the blueprint for the communist conquest of China in secret agreement at Yalta. That's exactly what happened. In fact, here you see a picture of these guys at Yalta. You see FDR sitting proudly next to the mass-murdering butcher Joseph Stalin. And notice right behind FDR, you see this guy here, Alger Hiss. Alger Hiss, of course, was the guy who was a key State Department official, guy who chaired the conference that wrote the UN Charter, guy who became the first Secretary General of the UN, and a guy who we promptly threw into federal prison after all of that because it turned out he was a spy for Joseph Stalin. Interesting. Right? Now, we know that the Chiang Kai-shek government was betrayed by its allies in the United States. If you don't remember the details of that war, Chiang Kai-shek was a very close ally of the United States in fighting the Japanese. In fact, he lost enormous numbers of men in that battle against the Japanese, actually in that war against the Japanese. In fact, my grandfather was a member of the U.S. Army during that war and actually fought in Japan. And so what happened after they started attacking Chiang Kai-shek was that they literally stuck a knife in Chiang Kai-shek's back. They put an arms embargo on him, if you can believe it. This was led by George Marshall, another globalist member of the Council on Foreign Relations, top leader in the military, top official in the State Department, eventually became Secretary of State. And he bragged about disarming the anti-communists led by Chiang Kai-shek with the stroke of a pen. Now, JFK, who certainly was no, you know, right-wing, raging, conservative radical, he pointed out on the floor of Congress, when he was a member of Congress, that the responsibility for the failure of our foreign policy in the Far East rests squarely with the White House and the Department of State. He said the continued insistence that aid would not be forthcoming to Chiang Kai-shek unless a coalition government with the Chinese Communists were formed was a crippling blow to the national government of Chiang Kai-shek. And of course, it was a devastating blow. It was a disaster. And as JFK put it, what our young men had saved, our diplomats and our president have frittered away. He was exactly correct. And this continues all the way to today, right? We have been aiding and abetting the rise of communist China after the communists took it over. And this continues, right? The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Thomas Moore, actually criticized Bill Clinton for helping to give some of our most sensitive military equipment to the Chinese. And he said, President Clinton promised to restrain those who ordered the Tiananmen Square massacre, but he has now allowed these men whose hands are stained with the blood of martyrs of freedom into the highest reaches of our military defenses and made available to them significant portions of our advanced military technology. Then, of course, we had the incident with Monica Lewinsky, the perjury, and everybody forgot all about Chinagate and how Bill Clinton betrayed our country and I would argue committed treason by giving the communist Chinese access to all of our sensitive information. And of course, we know the communist Chinese helped get him elected, right? They were funneling money through Johnny Chung to the DNC, and this all came out. And yet it all got swept under the rug because we were focused on the perjury and the sex scandal.
Our globalist government created the nuclear bomb threats, the communist threats. We put the communists in power in Cuba, the Soviet Union, China, North Korea. We funded the Nazi threats through the Bush family and many others, the Rockefellers. They loved Hitler. That was the role model for the world until that collapsed. Then we went with the Soviets. They propped up Hitler in every way possible. The threats of the global government, the World Economic Forum, and all that, the CFR, the United Nations, all coming from the globalist deep state in America. The Islamic threats. Why is Iran a threat right now? Because Jimmy Carter put the Ayatollah in power in Iran when they had a pro-American, freedom-loving Shah before that. We fund all the Islamic countries even right now. We've been funding Hamas and Israel. Hamas so they can buy weapons to fight Israel and vice versa. We love keeping it going. Bin Laden was an ally of the CIA. We funded him, built him up. Saddam Hussein funded, armed. We gave him bioweapons to use on Iran. And then later said, hey, wait, you have bioweapons. We got to take you out. The drug cartels. The CIA is the mastermind, the unseen hand behind the drug industry worldwide, and have for 50 years. In Mena, Arkansas, Clinton, when he was governor there, had a drug operation coming in, and some of the pilots that were flying the drugs in later came forward and said, we were flying in $100 million worth of drugs a month to Mena, Arkansas, and they were being distributed out of the governor's mansion in Arkansas through the corrupt police force and everything else. Good old Bill Clinton. Afghanistan. Why did we go into Afghanistan? Because we wanted to protect the poppy fields of the CIA where they were growing their drugs there. I mean, it's on and on. Why did the Ukraine war start? Because the globalists told Kamala Harris to go over there and say, we think the Ukraine should be part of NATO right now, even though the founder of NATO said, don't ever invite the Ukraine into NATO, or it will provoke Russia to strike. But, of course, that's what they wanted them to do. The bioweapons threat, whether it was the one Saddam Hussein used on his own people in Iran that we gave him, or COVID-19, or the vaccines, which are poison, or our food supply, which is poison, or the soil, which has been filled with poison. It doesn't matter. It's the globalist deep state that embedded themselves in our government 100 years, starting in the 1920s in earnest, and it's never been removed.
Ultimately, they want the New World Order to look very much like communist China. If you want to understand where this is going, here's George Soros, who in recent years has been a little bit critical of the CCP regime. But listen to what he says here in this interview with the Financial Times.
So I think you need a new world order, that China has to be part of the process of creating it, and they have to buy in. They have to own it the same way as, let's say, the United States owns the Washington Consensus, the current order.
The most murderous regime in the history of humanity needs to own the New World Order, kind of like the United States owned the previous order. Klaus Schwab, very, very sympathetic. In fact, they've bragged that for 40 years, the World Economic Forum has been helping to build up the Chinese economy. Here he is talking to Chinese propaganda television.
I respect China's achievements, which are tremendous over the last over 40 years since the opening up and policy and reform policy came into action. I think it's a role model for many countries.
Yeah, the most murderous regime in history is a role model for many countries. I really respect them. Isn't that nice? And of course, this is not new, right? You go back to 1973. David Rockefeller just came back from China. He wrote in the New York Times from a China traveler that the social experiment in China under Chairman Mao's leadership is one of the most important and successful in human history. Isn't that interesting, right? Now, David Rockefeller, one of the wealthiest men to have ever lived in the history of humanity, chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations, boasted in his memoirs on page 405 of working with a secret cabal of internationalists conspiring against the best interests of his own country to form a one-world political and economic order. Literally, go read it on page 405. This is a guy who says the so-called social experiment in China under Chairman Mao is one of the most successful in human history. Yes, only tens of millions of people murdered. Isn't that great, right? Same thing going on with North Korea, believe it or not. In 2002, Heritage Foundation said North Korea was the fourth largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid. Why would you be pouring foreign aid money into a government that has openly sworn hostility to your country and everything you believe? Right? In fact, the UN has been using American money to help the North Korean communists do whatever they want. The UN Development Program actually built them a semiconductor factory. And of course, they used that semiconductor factory to build missiles that are, of course, today pointed at the United States, our allies, and our armed forces. Okay. Again, this is not new. General Douglas MacArthur exposed some of the U.S. government's quiet aiding and abetting of the North Korean communists in his book, Reminiscences. He says, I was forbidden hot pursuit of enemy planes that attacked our own. Manchuria and Siberia were sanctuaries of inviolate protection for all enemy forces and for all enemy purposes, no matter what depredations or assaults might come from there. Why would the U.S. government say that General MacArthur and his forces could not chase down the North Korean communists? Why would they do that? Right. He goes on to say, then I was denied the right to bomb the hydroelectric plants along the Yalu. The order was brought in to include every plant in North Korea, which was capable of furnishing electric power to Manchuria and Siberia. Most incomprehensible of all was the refusal to let me bomb the important supply center at Racine, which was not in Manchuria or Siberia, but many miles from the border in Northeast Korea. He says this depot was the one which the Soviet Union forwarded supplies from Vladivostok to the North Korean army. Now, MacArthur also quotes the Chinese communist general Lin Biao in his book. He says, I would never have made the attack and risked my men and military reputation if I had not been assured that Washington would restrain General MacArthur from taking adequate retaliatory measures against my lines of supply and communication. Isn't that interesting that even the Chinese communists knew that General MacArthur would be restrained from doing anything? Now, even to this day, they're still making these kinds of nonsensical arguments, right? John DeLury, writing in Foreign Affairs, says if the United States really hopes to achieve peace on the Korean Peninsula, it should start finding ways to make Pyongyang feel more secure. Yeah, that's what we need, is for Kim Jong-un to feel more secure, right? Among other schemes, he says that we should grant him a security guarantee. We should normalize diplomatic relations. We should acknowledge their sovereign right to a space program. We should send even more tax-funded aid, he says. And in exchange, North Korea would provide slave labor for American businesses with its industrious, disciplined, and educated workforce. Okay, this is the current perspective of the globalists. All right, we can visit Cuba. The U.S. government put Fidel Castro in power, of course. Our own ambassador, Earl Smith, our U.S. ambassador to Havana, said that we, in the Senate hearing, we are responsible for bringing Castro in power. He explains how this happened in his book, The Fourth Floor, An Account of the Castro Communist Revolution. He says that without the United States, Castro would not be in power today. That's what he said in sworn testimony before the U.S. Senate Internal Subcommittee. Internal Security Subcommittee. By the way, this book, The Fourth Floor, that fourth floor refers to the top leadership of the State Department. Here you see David Rockefeller. Oh, look at those loving eyes when he stares at Mr. Fidel Castro, right? Here he is. I mentioned his comments in his memoirs. Some even believe me, we are part of the Rockefeller family, part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists, and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure, one world, if you will. He says, if that's the charge, I stand guilty, and I'm proud of it. There you can see it in his little memoirs right there. Again, page 405 if you want to get a copy. And, you know, one of the purposes of our intelligence agency supposedly was to keep us safe from communists. And yet, that's not what they were doing. In fact, almost everywhere you go, they were aiding and abetting communists, with a handful of exceptions. And when Dick Novak, a columnist for the Washington Post, called this out, Charles Pink, the president of the OSS Society in the Washington Post, wrote a letter to the editor and said, regarding this charge that the OSS had been infiltrated by communists, he says the OSS was not infiltrated by communists during the war. It hired them. In other words, the veterans of the OSS wanted everybody to know, no, we didn't get infiltrated. We wanted the communists there. Same thing happened, of course, in Vietnam. Same thing in Southern Africa, right? Everywhere you look, the U.S. government has been aiding and abetting its enemies. I could go into great depth on what happened in South Africa. It's a tragedy. I used to live in South Africa. So you had the U.S. government literally pouring money and resources into known communist terrorist organizations that were waging a ruthless terrorist war on a very pro-America government that was overseeing critical minerals. Here you see Don Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, shaking hands with Saddam Hussein. Right, here are exclusive CIA files prove America helped Saddam as he gassed Iran. Right, so we were building up Saddam Hussein. Here you have the Washington Post. Iraq, declassified documents of U.S. show U.S. support for Saddam Hussein, okay? U.S. embrace of Saddam Hussein in the early 1980s, truly incredible, right? Reports on Iraqi chemical weapons, et cetera, et cetera. Here we have Biden funding both sides of the Israel-Hamas war, right? Sending money to Hamas, also sending money to Israel. Really, surprise, surprise. Well, at least the war on drugs is legitimate, right? At least, nope, sorry, guys. They're also building up, aiding and abetting the drug cartels, and they're actually helping to bring the drugs into the United States. And I've written about this very extensively in the New American Magazine and others for decades now. The Mexican president in 2009 said it's impossible to pass tons of drugs or cocaine to the U.S. without some grade of complicity of some American authorities. It's actually much worse than that. In 2014, there was an investigation by the Mexican newspaper El Universal that showed that for over a decade, the U.S. government had a secret deal with the Sinaloa drug cartel, allowing it to operate basically with total impunity. They could ship drugs into America at will, supposedly in exchange for intelligence cooperation. We actually had the head of the DEA, a guy called Robert Bonner, go on CBS and admit publicly that it was the CIA bringing the cocaine into the United States in cooperation with foreign governments. Listen to this little interview from some years ago.
Revealed that the government itself may have been running drugs. The head of the DEA at the time, Robert Bonner, said that a ton of pure cocaine worth hundreds of millions of dollars had been smuggled into the United States. And he blamed the CIA, saying the agency had joined the Venezuelan National Guard in drug smuggling.
Let me understand what you're saying. A ton of cocaine was smuggled into the United States of America by the Venezuelan National Guard?
Well, they...
In cooperation with the CIA?
That's exactly what appears to have happened.
So, our intelligence agencies are supposed to keep us safe from communists, and we're hiring communists and aiding and abetting communism all over the world. Our drug agencies, law enforcement agencies, intel agencies are supposed to keeping us safe from drugs, and they're working with foreign governments to import cocaine into the United States. They're supposed to be keeping us safe from gun violence, and of course, they are sending weapons to Mexican drug cartels and terrorist organizations around the world. You might remember Operation Fast and Furious, Project Gunrunner. This is where the Obama administration got caught literally transferring high-powered American weapons to brutal Mexican drug cartels. Incidentally, they were blaming the Second Amendment for this. You had multiple top officials saying, oh, look at the drug cartels killing people with American weapons. And then they got caught sending the weapons that were being used to kill people. And so they eventually claimed, oh, we were investigating somebody in Mexico. That's why we were shipping all the guns down there. Then it turned out that the guy they were allegedly investigating was, in fact, already on the FBI's payroll. Same thing with the jihadists, the Islamic extremists are supposed to be keeping us safe from Islamic extremism. And of course, they have been aiding and abetting Islamic extremism for decades, something that has continued all the way up to the present day. Right? It's very common knowledge that Al-Qaeda and bin Laden were U.S. allies. The CIA was aiding and abetting their efforts. ISIS, same thing. And we've had very prominent people admit some of this. Here's Hillary Clinton in Congress.
We also have a history of kind of moving in and out of Pakistan. I mean, let's remember here, the people we are fighting today, we funded 20 years ago.
Oh, the people we're fighting today, we funded 20 years ago. And they expect you to just believe that they're all a bunch of morons and, you know, sorry, we're so dumb. We just had no idea that sending Stinger missiles to crazy jihadists was not going to be a good idea. Here we go. More
went to work. And it was President Reagan in partnership with the Congress, led by Democrats, who said, you know what? Sounds like a pretty good idea. Let's deal with the ISI and the Pakistani military, and let's go recruit these Mujahideen, and let's get some to come from Saudi Arabia and other places, importing their Wahhabi brand of Islam. So,
yeah, what a great idea. And again, they're just all so dumb, right? They just had no idea this would end badly, right? Of course, if you believe that, I got a nice beachfront property in Nebraska. Now, here we have mainstream news. CIA-backed rebels fight alongside Al-Qaeda in Syria, right? Here you have a vice president admitting that we have been and our allies have been funding ISIS.
What did they do? They poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens, thousands of tons of weapons into anyone who would fight against Assad, except that the people who were being supplied were al-Nusra and Al-Qaeda, and the extremist elements of jihadis coming from other parts of the world.
Whoops. Oh, they're just so dumb. How are they supposed to know that giving weapons to terrorists was going to result in mass extermination of Christians and eventual attacks on Americans, right? Same thing in Libya. Right? You might remember the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. The U.S. government has known that the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group was a Al-Qaeda affiliate in Libya since 2007. We've got the documents. And yet they were very proudly supporting with weapons and air cover the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group while it was fighting Gaddafi, who incidentally also used to be a U.S. ally, along with Bashar al-Assad. They were both helping the U.S. government in their terror war, torturing people, etc., etc. Now, what about ISIS? Okay, ISIS was one of the big ones we were supposed to be very concerned about. Well, the U.S. government built and created ISIS. And if you think that's a stretch, just read their own documents. Here's a document from the Defense Intelligence Agency in 2012, where they said, and I'm quoting, "The West, Gulf countries, and Turkey support the Syrian opposition. They said the Salafists, the Muslim Brotherhood, and Al-Qaeda in Iraq are the major forces driving the insurgency in Syria." So, you know, we were told that these were moderate rebels. So, you know, we knew that the West was supporting the Syrian opposition. We knew that Barack Obama was aiding and abetting this revolution. But we were told by the fake news that these were moderate rebels who believed in democracy and whatnot. Nope. Nothing could be further from the truth, and the government knew it, right? The rebellion, the insurgency, they admit, was led by the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda, okay? They said it in their own document. You go down, you keep reading in this document. It says, there is the possibility of establishing a declared or undeclared Salafist principality in eastern Syria. And this is exactly what the supporting powers to the opposition want. And again, we already reviewed the supporting powers to the opposition includes the U.S. government, the French, the British, the Gulf countries, Turkey. This is what they want, a Salafist principality, or a hardcore Islamic state in eastern Syria. Now, here's the map of Syria. You see right here the eastern part of Syria. And, of course, that is where the Islamic State was born. Now, Donald Trump correctly pointed out what had happened here. Listen.
Our government isn't giving us good protection. Our government has unleashed ISIS. I call President Obama and Hillary Clinton the founders of ISIS. They're the founders.
The founders of ISIS, right? And the fake media laughed. Oh, he can't say that. What a kook. The founders of ISIS. And then Donald Trump actually tweeted out a reference to that very document, which, of course, we know Hillary Clinton read. So they knew they were supporting Islamic extremists, Al-Qaeda, jihadists, under the guise of supporting moderate rebels. According to a report by Human Rights Watch, almost every high-profile domestic terror case across the United States since September 11th featured, and I'm quoting here, the direct involvement of government agents or informants. In some cases, like literally the entire terror plot from start to finish was actually led and financed by government operatives. You might remember the fake plot to kidnap Governor Whitmer in Michigan, right? The majority of the people involved in that plot were either working for the FBI or were informants for the FBI. And they found a couple of dumb potheads to, like, you know, pretend like they were part of their plan. And that whole thing fell apart. You might remember they all got cleared by a jury. So that was an FBI plot, folks. There never was any, you know, advanced plot to kidnap Governor Whitmer because she was a tyrant. It was all the FBI. Okay. We've seen this over and over and over again. January 6th is another example. Now, they have also plotted false flag attacks, right? We've got Operation Northwoods. This was the Department of Defense planning to launch fake terrorist attacks against the United States, including civilian targets. And one of the ideas they had was to shoot down an airliner. Another idea they had was to do bombings in Miami, my hometown. Yet another one was to sink a boat full of Cuban refugees. And they said in this document, thankfully John F. Kennedy refused to go along with it, but they said the desired resultant from the execution of this plan would be to place the United States in the apparent position of suffering defensible grievances from a rash and irresponsible government. And there you go, right? Would be used as a pretext to start a war. The CIA had a similar idea, Operation Mongoose. They wanted to develop a terror campaign in the Miami area that would then be used to start a war. Okay? Now, more recently, we had an invisible enemy. You might remember the invisible enemy, right? I'll let them speak for themselves.
American people, that we're doing everything we can each day to confront and ultimately defeat this horrible, invisible enemy. We're at war. In a true sense, we're at war. And we're fighting an invisible enemy. Think of that.
Okay, you heard it. We are at war with an invisible enemy. In a real sense, he says, we're in a war. Okay, so where did this invisible enemy come from? Well, I'm glad you asked. National Institutes of Health documents provide new evidence that the U.S. funded gain-of-function research in Wuhan. NIH official finally admits that taxpayers funded gain-of-function research in Wuhan. In fact, here they are in Congress, the head of the NIH admitting all of this under oath.
Dr. Tabak. Did NIH fund gain-of-function research at the Wuhan Institute of Virology through Echo Health?
It depends on your definition of gain-of-function research. If you're speaking about the generic term, yes, we did, but this is research, the generic term is research that goes on in many, many labs around the country. It is not regulated, and the reason it's not regulated is it poses no threat or harm to anybody.
Yeah, until COVID escapes from the laboratory, and then we have to fight a global war on an invisible enemy and take away all your freedom and inject you with mRNA concoctions. So you see how this works, right? Now, finally, with the new Trump administration, we're no longer funding this ridiculous group. So folks, this is how they work, right? This is something they've been working on for a very long time. They have this plan to create their little new world order, and it very much involves conflict. It very much involves building up enemies, right? I want to talk for a minute just here about this guy, Carol Quigley. He was a big-time globalist. He saw himself as part of the deep state, and he said they had this goal. He wrote a book where he kind of spilled the beans. He said his chief difference of opinion was that they didn't want to be known, and he thought they ought to be known. He says their goal was a system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country. He said that it would be a neo-feudalist system. And he said, you know, this idea of two parties with opposed ideas, that's ridiculous, right? The two parties should be almost identical so that we can throw the rascals out without any profound or extensive shifts in policy. Of course, the leaders of the government have believed this for a long time. And he says that this international network that's leading this campaign, he says the network, which we may identify as the roundtable groups, has no aversion to cooperating with the communists or any other groups, and it frequently does so. And so then you come to like the newest iteration of communism in America, the Black Lives Matter movement, right? They'll tell you that they're communists. Here's one of the co-founders, Patrice Cullors.
I also think that it might, I think of a lot of things. The first thing I think is that we actually do have an ideological frame. Myself and Alicia in particular are trained organizers. We are trained Marxists.
Trained Marxists, huh? Here's another one of the co-founders, Opal Tometi, hanging out with the murderous dictator of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro. Isn't that cute, right? She literally posted this on her X account, okay? Then you got the last but not least of the three amigas who founded this thing, Black Lives Matter, admitting that they want a new world order, just like all those globalists, right? So they're Marxists, but they want the same thing as George Soros, the billionaire super capitalist. That is interesting. Listen.
Alicia, what do you think's at stake in November election?
Everything. Like everything is at stake. And I'm really not being facetious about that. Yeah. To be real, what's at stake is whether or not a new world order is able to take root and grow.
That's what's at stake, folks, whether we can have a commie new world order. And by the way, you all know as well as I do that Black Lives Matter brought to you by, you know, the U.S. Bank and Bank of America and Delta and American Airlines and Nike and Adidas and George Soros and, you know, all these super capitalist Fortune 500 companies pouring money into this rat hole called Black Lives Matter that is openly telling you they're Marxists, they want a new world order, and of course they're also talking to their spirit friends and stuff. So, you know, at this point we come to an obvious question. Like, because there's only really two options here, as I say. These people are all either total morons, and they don't understand that giving weapons to jihadists and aiding and abetting the rise of communists and helping smuggle drugs into the country, you know, they don't understand that this stuff is going to be problematic, or there's a plan. And I'll defer to Secretary of Defense James Forrestal. He was quoted by Senator McCarthy in his autobiography. So James Forrestal says, consistency has never been a mark of stupidity. If the diplomats who have mishandled our relations with Russia were merely stupid, they would occasionally make a mistake in our favor. If the leaders who keep building up our enemies were merely stupid, every once in a while, at least every once in a while, there'd be an accident and wow, that benefited America. Wow, like, you know, America's now richer or freer or you know, our enemies are now weaker. But it never happens, right? It's always the same thing. The establishment, the Wall Streeters, the billionaire class, the elitists, if you will, have been aiding and abetting the rise of our enemies for generations. And they won't stop until we make them stop, right? So what do we do? Well, there's a lot we need to do. We need to pray. We need to be in the Word of God. We need to be holding our elected officials accountable. We need to be demanding hearings on this. We need people to be held accountable, right? You can't build up terrorist groups. You can't send weapons to Al-Qaeda to overthrow a foreign government and then say, well, I'm CIA, so the laws don't apply to me. Baloney, okay? We have federal laws on the books that make it a felony to provide aid to a terrorist organization. Why are so many former officials who we know provided aid to terrorist organizations still running around? Why are so many officials who aided and abetted the rise of communist China still running around free? Right? Why is this happening? We've got to have these people held accountable. We've got to get involved in the process. And of course, we need to pray that God would guide us as we seek to root out this evil from among us and turn the tide. So thank you, guys. Thank you, Curtis, for having me, Agenda Weekly. It's a great honor to be with you guys. I really, really appreciate it. Keep fighting the good fight. I hope I will see you again soon. And really, God bless you all. Keep fighting the good fight, and we'll talk soon.
I know there was a lot of information today, but it was important information. Again, I hope you'll watch it again. I hope you'll share it with many people, because we need to understand the big picture of things so that we're not ever deluded into thinking, no, we can trust these people. They're talking patriotically like we have for so long. Our verse for this week is Hebrews 13:8. This is encouraging in the midst of an uncertain world, a world where it's hard to count on anything. Everything's always changing and flipping on us, and definitions of words and genders and everything. Listen to this. Jesus Christ, the same yesterday and today and forever. He never changes. He never will. He cannot, and he never has. That's some good news, because we know from John 3:16 that he loved us, he died for us, and he rose again to prove to us he was who he said he was. But anyway, thank you so much for joining me. And until next week, God bless you.